Sober on Purpose is the podcast that takes you beyond clean to fulfilling your dreams. Other programs get you sober. We ask, what's next? Come thrive with us.
Hello, Sober on Purpose family. I have a guest from Lightning in the Bottle. Is that the best name ever? She's over in Savannah, Georgia. She's a mom of teenagers. She does one of my favorite therapy practices, which is EMDR. So this is Andrea Epting. She is certified in all kinds of things as far as a counselor, sex addiction, and a master addiction counselor as well. We have got so much to talk about. And Lightning in the Bottle is her platform. So we'll put all those links below. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you so much, Tanya. It's so good to be here. And I love the name of your podcast, Sober on Purpose, because it is definitely an on purpose pursuit.
Well, I was just listening to something and the therapist was saying, you know, families get unhealthy by accident, but they get healthy
on purpose.
And it can just be one person at a time.
So true.
And yep. You have so much experience. We were talking beforehand that I'm like, we're going to have to do 3 or 4 episodes to do this. I would really like to talk about the betrayal aspect of addictive behavior. And when the family goes, wait, we thought this was happening like this and now it's changing. Mm-hmm. So give us some idea and some examples of what that betrayal aspect is about.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got a podcast on, you know, addiction and family roles and family recovery. So we understand the role that trauma plays in all of this. Well, betrayal is abuse. It is trauma. It is something that lives in our body and eventually is going to affect us psychologically, physiologically, and it plays out and it manifests itself through addictive or unwanted behaviors. And so betrayal is a big part of the underlying reasons that people wind up acting out their addictions or acting out family secrets, right?
Yeah. So talk about, I was just talking about the secret of shame. That's what we did in the group this morning. Talk about how betrayal gets set up. And it isn't only the person in active addiction that does the betrayal. The family does it too. So share with us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I would say the person in active addiction is oftentimes the one acting out the betrayal. However, and they do it through, you know, chemicals acting out, sometimes all different types of behavioral acting out, could be, you know, sexual compulsivity, shopping, you know, eating disorders, restrictive or binge types. I mean, all types of ways. However, it is typically going to be betrayal that happened in the family long, long, long before any acting out behaviors were ever discovered or uncovered.
So tell us, give us some examples from your experience of what that betrayal will look like.
Oh my gosh. I mean, like when we're talking about betrayal trauma, oftentimes it's in some pretty covert messaging from childhood. So it's not always this, you know, overt thing or this abuse, something that we would call abuse, but over time, it is definitely experienced that way. It's embodied that way. We develop these negative core beliefs that start to really dictate, if you will, the way we experience the world and live in our relationships, yes, in the family of origin, but in future relationships as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I hope that starts to answer your question.
Give us the definition of that early betrayal. I would say it is those unwritten rules that if I'm a good mother, then I don't let my child go out without a coat. If I'm a good wife, I make sure my husband looks good at this point in time. Or it might be the can't win rule, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't ask for help, even when we really need help, because if we ask for help, we look like we need help. So we can't ask for help. So we're kind of stuck in this circle.
Yeah. And so, and also just to piggyback off that, I mean, it's like the messages that certain things are good, certain things are bad, certain things are always, certain things are never, certain things, you know, make you unworthy. Certain things make you unlovable. Certain things make you important or unimportant. I mean, it's just so many subtle messages acquired over time, but you're generally getting the same few messages from the same person, you know, for decades. And mm-hmm. that really starts to manifest itself as these negative core beliefs.
So when you, what kind of negative core beliefs does a person typically have when they turn to substance use?
I'm not enough. That's a big one. I'm not going to survive this. Nothing really matters anyway. Everything I try, I fail. Things of that nature. So it really, it starts to look and feel like self-pity. Mm-hmm. And maybe some deprivation, and maybe just, you know, feelings and experiences, and maybe even developing into the disease of depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. And then the need to medicate that is where the chemicals come in, if you're talking mm-hmm. about chemical addiction.
Now, how does that manifest in performing and work and mm-hmm. eating and relationships? How does it manifest there?
Yeah. So, I mean, so many different ways, but you're either underperforming or overperforming in general. So you're going to be, you know, in addiction, it's part of this like pendulum swing that goes too far the other way. It's like it's very uncomfortable with gray. So it gets sucked to either abuse or deprivation. It gets sucked into this realm of always or never. So it's like I'm going to go and be the very, very best to the point of burnout. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to overdo and overindulge, or it's going to be the opposite where I don't show up and try at all because that's too painful. So either way, it's addictive. It's an avoidance of pain and suffering. It's an attempt to avoid pain and suffering. But it shows up in those polarized ways. Like if you look at somebody who's addicted to stimulant drugs, oftentimes you're going to look at, if you will, so like overcompensating, overperforming, overdoing more. Be somebody who is, you know, underperforming, fearful of showing up consistently, things of that nature.
Now, I've seen it, and I imagine you've seen it, where you have 2 to 3 children in the family. One is the hero, who's the overperformer. One is the one who either disappears or just really isn't there and is pretty checked out. How do you help a family deal with that after the parent or both parents have gone into recovery? How do you help them relook at their children and understand why that's happening?
Sure. And I love the family roles perspective because we are going to fill the role. We're going to meet the needs of the system. And that's where a lot of that trauma and that dis-ease comes into play because we're playing a role. We're not authentically ourselves. We're playing that role. So you're the eldest. So, you know, stereotypically, you're going to wind up being the hero, or you are the scapegoat, or you are that, you know, mascot or the lost child. So you're like filling a role of the family. And that's how we want to describe it to them and to the recovering parents. It's like, look, they have tried to overcompensate or compensate in these ways, and they are going to have to shed themselves of, yes, the shame, but also the masks and the roles that they played. So that's one of the ways that I would try to address it as people are working towards recovery in the home.
So when they're looking at these roles, that's not their identity.
It's not who they are.
So they're, how would you describe their identity separate from their role?
Yeah, that's something that they would work on in therapy to really like uncover, probably for the first time, because mm-hmm. if they've been in an addicted family system, they don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't really understand who they are mentally, emotionally, intellectually, sexually, all these different ways. Like they are not self-aware yet. So that thing that happens is allowed in recovery. It's one of those beautiful things that comes as a result of a recovered or a recovering system.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, and I'm going to say this loud for the audience, It is not just the person who's using substance who needs help in this system.
Absolutely not.
And so if I've been the scapegoat, I grow up, I go out, I take my survival skills as the scapegoat, go out and try and connect with a partner who's not expecting me to be that way. What am I going to get in return?
Yeah, you are somewhat, I hate to say doomed, to repeat the patterns that you have learned based on the role that you've been playing in your system. So you're going to continue to find that in other relationships. It might be your romantic relationship, might be a relationship with your boss or a superior or some other relationship. But yeah, if you are the scapegoat, then you're probably going to find another enabler.
To continue the same thing. How would you begin to break out of that pattern? What would you need to do when you realize? So I had a realization that I'm not the scapegoat. I'm the first child, the hero child, and have this hero complex of it. Yeah. I'm taking it into work. I'm taking it into my marriage. I'm taking it into my community. And what it looks like for me is I can handle it. I can handle it. I can handle it. I'll take it all on.
Until? Right?
Breaking that. When I began to break that in my family system, I had to learn how to break it at work. I had to learn how to break it in the community, at the PTA, over here, you know, I will make this happen. I know my process, but what would you do with a person who said, oh, it's showing up everywhere?
And I think that's the key, is someone getting to the point where they recognize, oh, it's showing up everywhere. Oh, I have gotten caught in this pattern. Okay. Oh, I have been to some degree programmed and I'm acting that out consistently in all my relationships. Because a lot of people at first, when they walk through my door, they're still in some denial, some pre-contemplation, if you will, about where they are and how they're moving through the world. So, I mean, I think we start with kind of chipping away as is possible. On that denial and just, you know, starting to allow some of the pain to come up and to see like, yeah, wow, this is everywhere. This is a part of me. And once they get to that place where they're in preparation and in action, like, yeah, the sky's the limit. They will do what you did and start to go into all these different environments and address some of the problem behaviors. And that leads to healing, and boundaries is a huge part of that.
Absolutely.
So going into all those environments, learning about yourself and setting appropriate boundaries so that you can heal and overcome, you know, it's, I say reprogramming, but it really is about like understanding our default mode networks, understanding the neurological networks that we've been gravitating towards or falling into for years. When you start into recovery, you start to develop an ability to pause and make new decisions, make better decisions. You can pause and set a boundary. But that takes a while. That's not something that happens right away.
You were saying what used to be the ugliest word in my vocabulary, which was pause. And I'm like, what do you mean pause? This needs to be handled now. I need to do this now. We need to take care of this now. Everything in my brain just ticks now. And I will handle it. And when my EMDR therapist said, Tanya, take a breath, pause. I'm like, you are asking me to drown.
And that's how it felt.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You know, and you know, like you asked about lightning in a bottle, right? I'm gonna try to point to it. So lightning in a bottle, you know, I, like you, am ADHD, but that's that pause piece. I'm going to catch the ping, 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 mm-hmm. and pause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's mm-hmm. harness it. Mm-hmm. Let's pause.
So we did some work around that, and my son also is struggling gifted. Let's do gifted instead. I had him evaluated, and the evaluating person said, look, your brain is like a Lamborghini. It is fast and it's ready to go and it's powerful. Your job is to learn how to drive it. There's nothing wrong with it, except for that you're probably living with a lot of people who are single thought people, and learning how to drive it is huge. So with the audience listening to us and they're beginning to see things showing up in patterns, what do they need to be asking themselves about these patterns.
Well, I loved your analogy, and you said learning how to drive it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what people start to recognize is I'm not in the driver's seat. This Lamborghini is driving me, and I'm held hostage in the back seat. Like, or I might be in the trunk, you know, in chains.
Bound in the trunk with your eyes closed. I mean, you're like this.
Right. And I think that that's where people, you know, start to perk up, and it's like, okay, this is like a problem now. Yes. Like, I'm not driving. I am not in the driver's seat. Something else, this compulsive behavior, is driving me, and it's blowing up my life. It's leading to negative consequences all over the place.
And there's been a turn. I'm going to say this word. There's been a turn away from this word. So if you're offended by it, there are other choices. I came into this work 20 years ago, and codependency was still real common, and Melody Beattie, and that word was okay. I think that word's okay as long as you...
As long as it's accurate.
well, I like to use, I struggle with codependency rather than I am codependent. I'm a daughter of God. I'm a powerful, capable person. I am all these things. And I struggle with this. And that is, it's interesting that we can recognize the compulsion when we see it in alcoholism, workaholism, food addiction, all those things. We can recognize it. What is harder to recognize, at least for me, and maybe for your clients too, was I needed you to be okay so that I could be okay, so that I could feel safe. Because if you weren't okay, then I wasn't doing my job right, and I could spend my time shaming myself. Mm-hmm. How do you help? You know, that's where I see a lot of denial, is if they would just, and how do you, in a family system, help the whole family go, no, it's not if they would just, we've got to shift the whole mindset.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we talked earlier about negative core beliefs, and like, that's part of it. It's, you know, giving 100% of your power away by saying, if they would just. So yeah, I think that's, you know, problematic. So I think it's really, you know, recognizing that when you try to control somebody else and their behaviors, that is a desire to minimize and treat your own anxiety. And so coming at it from that approach and just understanding, like, what's the secondary gain of this fixation you have on this other person's disease, and unpacking it and understanding, like, I am getting something out of this. You know, this actually is selfish. This isn't selfless. I am no martyr in this. This is about my own medicating. And I think that's how people start to turn a corner there.
But I'm so good at the martyrdom. I am really good at the martyrdom. And I have seen, you know, well, if you loved me, if you wanted to take care of me, if you were doing this, that, and the other. And as I began to pull out of that, I began to realize I didn't know my role. I didn't know who I was. And the other big thing was, I didn't know what home looked like. If I wasn't fixing somebody or something, I was out of a job. And why would they want me? Why would they need me?
But that's also what happens when people start to identify with their disease, right? Like, that's my identity.
Yeah.
That's who I am.
Yes.
And that's bullshit. That's not true.
So that's why, you know, AA and Al-Anon have been tremendous in my life. I don't want to say I'm a codependent, I'm this, because that's not who I am. That's not the totality of me.
Right.
And I think, having been in those rooms for a long time, you get stuck in that this is who I am, and it can become an excuse for your behavior. I'm going to guess you're here because you have a loved one who is either in full-blown addiction or is looking for recovery. You're not here just to talk about chickens, which we could talk about chickens, but you're not here for that. You're here because you're at possibly where I was 12 years ago. You're surfing the internet looking for hope, looking for help, looking for a way to maintain this beloved family, this beloved marriage, this lovely child. You are looking for something. Well, stop looking at Tanya Joya Coaching, we realize that the family is not hopeless, is not helpless, and is not powerless to help the addicted loved one get well. We fully realize that you have been doing everything for everybody and you're exhausted, even if you don't have 400 chickens. We completely understand that while this is no laughing matter, you need a little levity. You need a little joy. You need a little hope in your life. So look no further. We have an Arise from Addiction Facebook group, or if you want to talk to me immediately and say, look, I just need help, where I was 12 years ago, surfing the internet at 3 and 4 in the morning going, I just need somebody who can tell me a story of hope. I want you to join the Rise Above Addiction Facebook group. And then I want you to reach out to hello@tanyajoya.com. It's all in the notes below. You can do this. You can make extraordinary changes. But what I understand is you're waiting. You're waiting for them to fix themselves when you can be part of the solution. So stop waiting. Become the cherished wife, not the nagging wife. Make sure that you check into our Facebook group at Arise from Addiction on Facebook. We'll look forward to seeing you there. Now, do I fail? Yes. So I really am owning up to, I can't handle it all. I am overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I need help. That's mm-hmm. been a hard thing. How does that play into the whole family recovery process when the person who has been paying the bills, managing the kids, managing the household, holding mm-hmm. it together, suddenly goes, whoo, I can't do that anymore? What's yeah. been your experience?
I love it. And I kind of often see it where the enabler is the first one motivated to stop the cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, the enabler is like, I'm literally killing myself. I'm physically killing myself. I am dying. I now, you know, can't function. And so when that enabler gets healthy and they're like, yeah, I'm not going to live this way anymore. And they start setting, you know, inappropriate times, of course, mm-hmm. not just ripping the cord out, but setting appropriate boundaries so that other people can feel their worth and their value and take responsibility and be accountable. The family gets better, whether it's the enabler first or the active addict first or the lost child first, whoever it is, creates this opportunity for the whole system to heal. And whether it heals or not, which is not a guarantee, it is going to change if you change. It has to.
And like you said, it could take any person. It could mm-hmm. be the lost child who says, I cannot do this anymore. I cannot be lost anymore. I need my name, mm-hmm. whoever I am. When you're helping a family through that, you said just... It's not the practice anymore just to rip the cord away and go, okay, everybody needs to move out. You need to be in separate places. Sometimes that needs to happen, but how do you help families do this in a way that they don't suddenly just have to disconnect and kick everybody to the curb?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's danger to some degree. And of course, it depends on every situation and scenario, but I think there's danger in that pendulum swing I talked about earlier, where you go from abuse to deprivation, where you go all the way from always to never. Mm-hmm. I think people really do run the risk when they first start setting boundaries of going a little too far the other way, like a little bit into the dark side. So that's part of where therapy comes in and talking and sponsorship comes in and meetings come in. And all of that is just a space to really process, like, what is healthy for me? What promotes my safety and my sanity, and making decisions based on that? Because sometimes it doesn't help our sanity to cut someone off
mm-hmm.
cold
mm-hmm.
turkey.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
sometimes that's just not the best choice.
So tell us how you've seen some of this play out in the families you've worked with.
Oh my gosh. What I have seen consistently, I mean, and I too have been doing this for, you know, 20 years, and I've seen it play out so many different ways, so many different scenarios, but that one thing is consistent. if we can help the motivated party, if we can help that person who is somewhere between preparation and action shift and make positive changes and maintain those changes, then the family system can heal, improve, and recover. And they definitely are now have this opportunity for healthy change. And so, like, that's what I see consistent. It plays out in so many different ways, so many different dynamics. Of course, I have worked with mothers who have, you know, needed to set boundaries that would inevitably allow their child to go to prison for a long time. Mm-hmm. Okay. But mm-hmm. was that what ultimately was best for the active addict and the enabling parent? Absolutely. It was healing for both parties. Okay. So, like, I have seen it where, like, yes, this is extreme. This is dangerous physically, not just psychologically. And we have to go ahead and make some pretty abrupt shifts and changes that will inevitably harm, at least from their perspective, at least at first, somebody else. Mm-hmm. But when we play the long game here, right, this is a marathon. It's not what is going to feel good now. It's mm-hmm. what are we working towards long term? So, yeah, I mean, I think it's played out so many different ways, but I think just identifying, you know, the motivated party and working with them to make some progress towards recovery, it helps the whole family. It helps the whole system.
And you never know. We've had so many friends who have passed away. You never know if that jail time or the rehab time or whatever they're doing has kept them alive. Mm-hmm. Had they kept on the path they're on. And when you blow this out, I always come back to dignity. If I'm trying to control you and your behaviors to make myself okay, then I'm not seeing you as a full human being. I'm seeing you as somebody that I'm able to control and manipulate for my purposes, which I'm not even seeing myself as a full human being.
That's right.
How do you see human dignity and commonality playing into this with the families that you help?
Yeah. I mean, I love the way you put that. And I think that that's a consistent message. We go back to those messages that sent is that you can't do it. I have to do everything, which means you can't. You're not capable. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't, you know, carry the amount of dignity or worth or value that it would take to do the things that I'm having to do for you, having to do for you. Right. So, I mean, I think that it shows up in a lot of the negative messaging.
Well, and my fear is if I don't manage this for you, harm could come. And if harm comes to you, if I'm standing in my codependency, if harm comes to you, then harm comes to me. And then I'm the person who failed. And so to me, it is so convoluted as I have worked it out. I'm like, well, no, I didn't fail. If I stand in my authenticity and you still make choices that harm you, the best thing I can do is hold space for you.
Yeah. And give people credit. Give credit where credit's due.
Yes. You know? Yes. And we were talking earlier about the entrepreneurship. I have seen it multiple times where the addictive behaviors, food, work, whatever, they make excellent entrepreneurs because they're going to get what they need to make this work. Praising what you want and not going after what you don't want, helping things go right, has been a hard scenario for me because, again, I'm out of a job. If you could do it all by yourself, I'm out of a job. That is so uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think too, it's just, I don't know. Like, I ask myself these questions often. Like, I will pause because I can do that now. I can access my frontal lobe and I can pause and I can say, how do I want to feel at the end of this disaster that is inevitably going to happen?
Oh my goodness. That's an excellent question. We've got something happening in our lives right now. And that's the question that I need to be asking myself is how do I want to feel at this? I think I could kick in their perceived disaster because it may or may not happen, but I'm looking down the road going,
sure.
And you can, it's going to happen.
You can see some writing on the walls. I mean, like we're not mind readers like we'd like to believe, you know, right. And if you come from an addicted system, I got to say this, if you come from an addicted system, you've been leaning on your intuition your whole life. But when you lean too far into your intuition, you start to believe you're a mind reader and you start to misconstrue a lot of scenarios. but it is important to stand in sometimes your frontal lobe and say, you know what, is all I have control over is me and my action here and now. And how do I want to feel about myself? Is this a time where I really need to stand firm in my truth and my integrity and do my part and then let it play out? Just drop the rope, you know, Woo! And oftentimes that's it.
Woo! I don't know if I can drop the rope.
Hey, 1 minute at a time, right? I mean, yeah. Like, not, let it loose. You know, because so many people drop the rope and then they're quick to pick it right back up, right? You know, oh, I'm going to drop the rope. And then they're like, whoo, no, let me go chase that rope and pull it back. And so it's 1 minute at a time.
Well, and that's so true, because my therapist would say, okay, put it down. Don't pick it back up for a week. I'm like, really? What am I going to do for that week?
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, I'm complaining that here's the interesting part. I'm complaining, well, I don't have enough time for myself. I don't have enough time to get my own work done. I don't have enough time to do the things that I want to do. Put the rope down, Tanya. Put the rope down. Let them live in their own dignity. Lovingly hand the problem back to them. But I can do it so much better and faster.
Yeah, well, that's true. You know, and I think about the analogy that I kind of have created for myself, and I sometimes bring it into my awareness in times like that, is, does it help for me to tie the shoelace so that we can get out the door? Mm-hmm. Or do I need to sit and be late to watch them tie that shoelace so that they can learn? Because what message am I sending when I'm like, oh my God, we're in such a hurry. Oh my God, let me just go ahead and do this for you. Mm-hmm. Like I just gave them 3 negative messages.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, whoa, let's wait. Let's just like pause and let them tie the shoe or screw it up. Or maybe it falls off. Maybe they trip. Maybe they lose a tooth, whatever. They'll learn something.
Yes, absolutely.
And I did that with the best of intentions, right? And I just have to lean on my intentions, not the results.
Oh, so important. When my guys were little, we had a time that we needed to be out the door, and they weren't super little. They were lower elementary school. Time that we needed to be out the door. Well, they just were not getting themselves ready. They were not getting themselves together. And so I said, okay, we're leaving. They're like, without shoes? I'm like, without shoes. Now, I brought the shoes to the school and left them. So they went an hour or two without shoes. But part of that was to say, you are capable. I'm not going to do it for you. There are going to be consequences. But it was very, for as young as they were, it was very set up and guarded so that there weren't huge mistakes.
It was a life lesson.
A life lesson.
We were able to create. Yeah.
Took a lot of thinking and time on my part, and not to be angry, because we think by force and by pushing we can make things happen. When we do that and then they get to be 250 pounds, and we want something done and we want to use force, we're like, can you please do that or I'm going to spank you. He looked down at me and he said, you're gonna what?
I'm going to try to spank you. Yes.
And you know, I don't know what people's ideas are on spanking, but he really did. He looked at me and he said, Mom, you're gonna what? Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? I hadn't set up the right scenario. And that's where that pause, which is becoming a more faithful word to me than a dirty word to me. And I play out for us just a little bit more on this family system as it begins to get healthy. Then what does it look like? How do people talk to each other? The secrets are beginning to die away. What does that look like when the family really pulls into that?
Oh gosh, it can look like all types of things. It can look like family members leaving the system forever. And that might be exactly what they need for their own mental health and their own recovery journey. It might look like good, honest communication. It might look like people talking about how they feel versus what they want someone else to do. It might look like people paying attention to the language they use and not saying, you know, now I have to. No, you choose to do that. And you choose to do that because you're trying to meet your own needs, not someone else's, you know? So like just, you know, it looks like for, in some cases, more structure, more boundaries, more respect. And sometimes it looks like a disconnect for a while. But we set boundaries. I have this whole podcast on it, and I have a PDF on it, but we set boundaries because we care. We set boundaries because we love. It comes from a place of warmth and good intention. Yes, that does mean that we might be, you know, disconnecting with love, but we do it. We set boundaries because we care. And I think that that's what it starts to look like in a family system, is what we call careful boundaries. And so that's what I think we can start to see.
That's awesome. And that's, so I'm sure your audience, or I'm sure the audience is familiar, because I keep talking about Brené Brown. When she jumped into self-compassion, she said, what I figured out were the people with the most intense boundaries were the most compassionate, because they could afford to be.
Because they could be.
Yes. Because they could be. And it sounds kind of backwards, but that woman who's saying, I'll do everything, I'll take care of everything, I'll do this, she's actually pretty empty on the inside. She's getting her validation from the outside, which, when that blows up, I've been there. You don't want to be around that person.
Yeah. And it's kind of that compulsive yes instead of a well-meaning, you know, because I'm a big believer in a, you know, heaven's yes and a hell no. Right. You know, if it's not one or the other, I mean, like, you know, and if you don't trust yourself not to compulsively say yes, let it be a maybe or maybe a no, and then circle back to somebody and be like, may, you know, I've thought about that and this is gonna be the best course of action. But yeah, I feel like a lot of people, especially in the realm of codependency, there's just a lot of people pleasing going on.
And you have circled back to that piece of, who am I in this system? Mm-hmm. Who do I choose to be in this system? Because I don't have to play out the roles that's expected. Mm-hmm. I can back up and figure out my identity. Yeah. What matters to me?
Not in adulthood, you don't have to. In childhood, yes, you do.
In childhood,
and that's one of the frustrating things. Yeah, that's one of the frustrating things is, you know, in childhood, when you are actually dependent on the system, you don't have a lot of choices. However, as you move into adulthood, you do not have to reenact your trauma. You do not have to stay in that role in future relationships or in your family of origin relations.
Great tools, great clarification, because as we talked about a little bit earlier, if I'm the lost child and I'm going to go date a hero who used to be a hero child, I'm bringing a totally different set of skills than what they have. And somewhere, I would imagine you would hopefully help them investigate what skills they're bringing and what they want to bring into the new family. Cause I don't have to bring that. That was really clear. So I've been married twice. This is my second marriage, but 20 years. I really did some more digging on, what do I want to bring into this? What is it that I want to set up for the family? You know, do we want to have dinner together? Do we want to play board games? Do we want to go camping? Do we want to do those things? We didn't have to do those things. And I think a lot of people, you were talking about it earlier, don't look at how intentionally they can choose what they want to do.
They don't know they have permission to.
Isn't that funny? We're adults, we're doing our own thing, we're paying our own bills, and we still have that string back to mom and dad that say, good families do this, good families do that, our family does this, why are you doing it like that?
Yeah, but it really doesn't feel, until you start doing this work of self-discovery and exploration, like it doesn't feel like that was an option, that was a choice. You know, because you've not really found your authentic self to even do that yet.
And that's the work that both you and I do, is how do you give yourself permission? You said it earlier, give yourself permission to do that. Andrew, where can we find you? Lightning in the bottle. Where can we learn more about you and the things that you have to offer and the team that you work with?
Yeah, and I do have the most amazing team on the planet, I feel. So I'm nothing without them. So thank you to the Lightning in a Bottle team. But if you want to look up our community, our digital course offerings, our coaching offerings. That's at www.lightninginabottle.biz, not .com, .biz, lightninginabottle.biz. And I kind of recommend the first way you engage with us is through our podcast, which is called Direct Impact. So if you search Direct Impact with Andrea Epteen or just Direct Impact, you're going to find us and you can get to know us a little better through the podcast. And maybe then you want to buy one of the Plan to Recover journals, because the P2R journal is a really great way to identify a few behaviors that you would like to either increase or disconnect with. And over a 90-day period, you really start to look carefully at those. And so I think the Plan to Recover journal, it's on Amazon. So you can just put in Andrea Epteen or the Plan to Recover journal. And if you're interested in starting a recovery journey, I think the journal is a great way to do that. But that's basically what we offer at Lightning in a Bottle. I have a private practice called Resolve Strategies, Inc. in Savannah, Georgia. And we do some workshops for people all over the country. So that's another thing to check out if you're interested in learning more about us and about me.
Awesome. Thank you. Now, we really didn't touch on sex addiction, so I do want to come back and revisit that. I know that's one of your topics, and I have several families who are like, you know, we got rid of the alcohol, but now this has surfaced again. So peeling the onion back, there's on this side of the grass, there's going to be work.
Absolutely. And I love it. That's the, you know, I started in substance abuse and, you know, gravitated very naturally towards behavioral addictions and compulsivity as a result of people getting clean and sober. And then, boop, those behaviors popped up or were, you know, exposed, if you will. And then, you know, we got to work on emotional sobriety at some point, too. So I do. I work a lot in the realm of betrayal trauma and sexual compulsivity, but also mood and food and dopamine deficiencies in general. So, yeah, I'm happy to come back and talk about those things.
So lots of things. And all of those topics, I imagine, are addressed on your podcast.
Absolutely.
So give us the name of the podcast one more time, and we will have links below, but just in case they're just listening.
Yeah, it's the Direct Impact Podcast.
Awesome. So she can address all of those things. And that's one thing that I have found is once you get deeper into the family, there's a lot more things going on than just what you see on the surface. So remember to trust God, tell the truth, clean house. And we will see you next time on Sober on Purpose.
Thank you so much, Tanya, for
having
me.
Thank you, Andrea.
You, beloved listener, are creative, resourceful, and whole. Do you want to add more purpose to your sober journey? Do you want to make room for the new and make your dreams a reality? Apply today for a dream session. Go to tanyajoya.com. That's TANYAGIOIA.com and apply today. Let's get you dreaming about your new purpose.